What are you relying upon? That's a fairly common question, isn't it, that we might get asked in a whole range of different situations. Approaching a set of exams, for instance, or participating in a sporting contest, or entering a business venture. What is it that you're relying upon? But I'm asking you that question this morning in an altogether higher and more serious context than any of those I've just mentioned. And the context is this: God's assessment of your life. The God who is, the God of heaven and earth, the God who made you, sees everything and knows everything. And he makes this morning a particular assessment of your life. He evaluates all its different components, all your words, your thoughts, your deeds. He assesses you. And it's in that context then that I'm asking you the question this morning: what are you relying upon? In the context of this divine assessment of your life, as God evaluates you this morning, what are you relying upon? Well, we're currently in our Sunday morning sermons working through the book of Romans. And the large section that we currently find ourselves in, from chapter 1, verse 18, to chapter 3, verse 20, basically has one very simple message. And it's this: we have nothing we can rely upon. We have nothing we can rely upon. Because Paul is saying that the simple fact is, we're not good enough. Our lives are inadequate. They are indefensible. They haven't met the required standard. It doesn't matter who we are. We might be Jews. Our lives are indefensible. We might be Gentiles. Our lives are indefensible. That is the solemn message of this whole section of the book of Romans, that we have nothing we can rely upon. When it comes to this matter of God's assessment of our lives, nothing we can rely upon. We have all failed to meet God's standards. But although, as I say, Paul in this section puts everybody in that same depressing boat, Jews, Gentiles, everybody, every man, woman, boy and girl on the planet, he puts in that same boat. He particularly emphasizes the Jews' indefensibility. He devotes much more space to them in this section of the letter than he does to the Gentiles. Now, this isn't because Paul is anti-Semitic or anything like that. Paul himself was a Jew. But the reason that Paul particularly goes to town about the Jews and particularly hammers home their indefensibility is because more than anybody else, the Jews thought that they had things they could rely upon. The Jews thought that they didn't really need to worry too much when it came to God's assessment of their lives. We saw, didn't we, last week, those of you who were here, that they had three objections to this whole idea that they might be found wanting by God. Objection number one: God isn't angry with us. If God was angry with us, it would be obvious. But our circumstances suggest he's not angry with us. Objection number two: we are the Jews. And our sheer identity as the Jews, that is enough in and of itself. Objection number three: we have the law. We have our standards. We have a sense of morality, a sense of right and wrong. And remember we saw how Paul deals with all each of these objections. Well, in the passage that we're looking at this morning, from verse 17 onwards, he really continues in very much the same vein. But if anything, he becomes now even more devastating as he pulls from beneath the feet of the Jews every single thing they thought they could rely upon. He's ruthless everything the Jews thought that they could rely upon when it came to God's assessment of them, everything that made them think they were all right, they're fine, they've nothing to worry about, Paul pulls it out from beneath their feet. Now, it might well be that this morning we are not Jews. But it might well be that some of us this morning have the same tendency as the Jews of Paul's day. That we too have the tendency to cultivate a false sense of security when it comes to God's assessment of our lives. It may be that we are unconcerned this morning about God's evaluation of us, because we say, well, I've got this to rely on, I've got this to rely on, I've got this to rely on. I've got all these things that I can rely upon. When the fact is that we haven't. And so, I think it could well be relevant this morning for some of us to have these things pulled from beneath our feet, as Paul does here in the case of the Jews. And so, there are three things in this passage that Paul says to these Jews you can't rely upon. Three things that they can't rely upon. First of all, they can't rely upon a privileged role. They can't rely upon a privileged role. Role, R-O-L-E. You see, this is what Paul talks about in verses 17 to 24. You see, the Jews did have a privileged role. God, you remember, back in Exodus chapter 19, verse 6, had said to Israel that you will be for me a kingdom of priests. You will be for me a kingdom of priests. In other words, Israel was to have a priestly role in relation to the rest of the world. In relation to all the other nations, Israel was to have this priestly role. And what that boiled down to in practice was that Israel was to teach the rest of the world. Israel was to teach the Gentiles the law of God, the Ten Commandments, because the Gentiles didn't have the law. God hadn't given it to them. We saw last week that they had some of its requirements written on their hearts by their Maker, but they didn't have it on tablets of stone like the Jews had. And so the Jews then, having been given the law by God, they have this responsibility, they have this privileged role of educating the Gentiles as to God's requirements. This is what Paul is talking about in verses 19 and 20. He says, you are a guide for the blind, a light for those who are in the dark, an instructor of the foolish, a teacher of infants, because you have in the law the embodiment of knowledge and truth. So though the blind here, and those in the dark, and the foolish, and infants are the Gentiles. And Paul is talking about the Jews' privileged role, which was to educate the Gentiles about the law of God. But the trouble is, the Jews were tempted to rely upon this privileged role. Notice how Paul, in the beginning of verse 19, says, you are convinced that you are a guide for the blind, and so on. And that strong word, convinced, it implies that the Jews, you see, they weren't just holding this role that God had given them quietly and humbly and inconspicuously, but they were shouting about it. They were making a big deal of it. They were saying, look at us Jews, we have this role of educating the rest of the world. God has given us this high calling. He's entrusted us with this significant responsibility. He must think highly of us. He must be pleased with us to give us this privileged role of teaching the Gentiles the law. Well, look how Paul responds to this. In verse 21, he says, you then who teach others, do you not teach yourself? And he has then this list of questions. You who preach against stealing, do you steal? You who say that people should not commit adultery, do you commit adultery? You who abhor idols, do you rob temples? It's difficult to know exactly what he means by that, robbing temples, but we don't need to go into that just now. You who brag about the law, do you dishonor God by breaking the law? And these are rhetorical questions, but the implied answer is yes, 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 yes. You who teach the Gentiles not to steal, you do steal. You who teach the Gentiles not to commit adultery, you do commit adultery. You who teach the Gentiles not to bow down before idols, you rob temples. You who brag about the law, you dishonor God by breaking the law. And in fact, he says, you do all these things to such an extent that you even drag God's name, verse 24, into public disgrace and disrepute. And Paul is saying then, to these Jews who made such a big deal of this role that they had. We're so privileged. God has given us this role of teaching the Gentiles the law. He's saying to them that yes, that may be a privileged role, but it's not something that you can rely upon. The fact that you have been given this role of teaching others the law doesn't hide or alter for one moment the fact that you break the law. And that's what counts in God's assessment of you. You've broken the law. Yes, you might have taught the law until you're blue in the face. You might have taught it diligently and eloquently and so on. But you've broken the law, and that's what counts in God's assessment of you. And this morning, perhaps, we might be tempted to rely upon a privileged role that we have been given. There are many roles that we might have which are privileged, whether it's being an elder in the Church of Jesus Christ, or being a Sunday school teacher, or being a church treasurer, or being a parent, or having some responsibility for the practical running of the church, or going into schools and giving assemblies, all kinds of different privileged roles that we might have. But God forbid that for one moment we should think that we can rely upon those roles that God has given us, that those somehow hide the fact that we've sinned, we've broken the law. That's how God sees us. That's God's assessment of us. We've broken his law. And all the privileges he's given us, they're real privileges, but they don't alter that for one moment. So let's not be found this morning relying on some privileged role or other that God has given to us. Second thing that Paul says the Jews can't rely upon is an external sign. An external sign. In verses 25 to 29. Because you see, another thing that the Jews were tempted to rely upon was their circumcision. The fact that they had this physical act of circumcision done to them. And they were tempted, you see, to see this physical act as a sign or a stamp even of God's approval. An infallible stamp of God's approval of them. We've got this unmistakable physical evidence in our very bodies that God accepts us, that God is pleased with us, that God is happy with us, that God endorses us. We have been circumcised. And again then, this became something that they relied upon. We've got this physical act, this physical sign, this physical right. We've been circumcised. Well, how does Paul deal with this then in these verses? Well, his basic point, really, is that you've misunderstood what circumcision is. You've got the wrong end of the stick. You've misconstrued what circumcision actually is. Circumcision isn't an infallible stamp of divine approval. It isn't this unmistakable evidence that God accepts you and is pleased with you. That's not what circumcision is. But first of all, notice that Paul does actually go along with the Jews for a moment. He goes along with them. And he says in verse 25 that circumcision, as in circumcision as you see it, circumcision as you Jews regard it, circumcision as this infallible stamp of divine approval, that would have value, he says, if you observed the law. If you kept the law in every single point, if you were righteous, if you were obedient, If you were 100% law keepers, then yes, circumcision as a stamp of divine approval would have some meaning, some relevance, some significance. But he says the moment that you disobey the law, the moment that you disregard it, that you transgress it, then circumcision has absolutely no value in that sense. If you're a lawbreaker, then circumcision has absolutely no value at all as a stamp of divine approval, as a sign of God being pleased with you. It's then irrelevant and meaningless as that kind of thing. So he first of all goes along with their definition, but then he comes in verse 28 and 29 to what circumcision actually is. He's saying it's not that. It's not a stamp of divine approval. It's not really, he says, a physical thing at all. Circumcision is an inward thing, he says. It's a thing actually within our hearts that God does by his Spirit, renewing us, changing us within. That's really what circumcision is, in the truest sense. And the physical part of it is just a signpost. It's just a sign pointer pointing to the inward thing. That's what circumcision is. It's something that God does within our heart. And so Paul is saying unto these Jews who are relying upon the fact they've had a physical act done to them, they've been circumcised. He's saying that, well, if you'd obeyed the law 100%, then you might have some reason to rely upon it. But the fact is you haven't, and you've misunderstood circumcision. Circumcision is simply a signposter to what God does in the heart. It's not a physical act to be relied upon. And again, this morning perhaps, you might be relying upon an external sign. You might be relying upon your baptism. Whether baptized as an infant, baptized as an adult, you might be relying on the physical act of having been baptized. The physical act of having had water applied to you. You might be saying, well, that's God's stamp of approval. 10 years ago, 20 years ago, whenever it was, I had a baptism. And therefore, God's pleased with me. But you see, that you've misunderstood what baptism is. Baptism, the actual physical act, is just a signposter. The cleansing isn't anything to do with the water. The cleansing is an inward thing which God does by his Spirit. And so you can't rely this morning upon a physical act. What matters in God's assessment of you is that you've broken his law. And no number of physical acts and external signs and rites that have been performed on you, whatever they may be, will do any good. God's assessment of you is you've broken his law. So don't be found relying upon that either this morning. Not upon a privileged role you have, not upon an external sign that has been performed on you. Thirdly, the third thing that Paul says the Jews can't rely upon is a distorted promise. A distorted promise. In chapter 3, verses 1 to 8. Because in chapter 3, Paul continues the same argument. He says, what advantage then is there in being a Jew? Or what value is there in circumcision? He's been so negative about these things that the Jews made so much of, that he could have been construed as saying that it's utterly meaningless being a Jew at all. But he's not saying that. He's saying there is an advantage about being a Jew. Much advantage, indeed, much in every way, he says. First of all, they have been entrusted with the very words of God. And he's talking here, I think, about the scriptures generally, the whole of the Old Testament, the whole of that revelation which God had given to his people. They had been entrusted with God's self-disclosure, with the holy scriptures of the Old Testament. But you see, the problem was that the Jews had been very selective in what they had taken from those Old Testament scriptures? In which bits of those words that God had entrusted to them, they had focused upon? It's a bit like the media today. You know how they specialize, don't they, in distorting people whom they've interviewed. So there might be someone interviewed for 10 minutes, and that's conveyed to the public in just a few sentences, which have been taken completely out of context. They've been selected, and so the whole thing is distorted. And that's what the Jews were like with the Old Testament. They latched on to certain things, and they made a big deal of those things, but they ignored the rest. And specifically, they latched on to God's promises. Promises of acceptance with Him, promises of blessing, promises of salvation, promises of status in His courts, all kinds of wonderful promises. They latched onto those, but they ignored the threats. They ignored God's threats that were also there in the Old Testament. And so, because they'd done this, because they had focused exclusively upon the promises, for them, God would only be righteous and faithful if He kept those promises and blessed them. Anything else, God would be unfaithful. God had made all these promises to them. And for God to be faithful, therefore, for God to be righteous, He had to keep those promises and pour out blessing upon the Jews. He had to accept the Jews. He had to accept them because of all these promises. And this was regardless, you see, of how they behaved. Regardless of whether they believed or not. Regardless of anything in their lives, they said, well, God has made these promises. That's it then. He's got to keep His promises, and everything else is regardless. But you see, Paul comes along and he's saying to these Jews, no, you have to believe in God. You have to have faith. There has to be a trust. There has to be a relationship on your part with God. And that's why then they say in verse 3, I think he's quoting these Jews, they say, they're saying, will our lack of faith then nullify God's faithfulness? The Jews are saying, well, if faith is so important, Paul, if we don't have faith, does that mean God then can be unrighteous? He can be unfaithful? He doesn't have to keep His promises anymore? That we, simply by not believing, can make God unrighteous? Because God won't then keep His promises. Well, what Paul reminds them of is, look at how emphatic he is. Not at all. Let God be true and every man a liar. And then he quotes from Psalm 51. And his point is that no, that won't make God unrighteous. Because God hasn't just given promises, He's given threats as well. God has said, if you disobey me, I will do this. If you sin, I will do this. If you live this kind of life, I will do this. He's given threats as well as promises. And so it's not unrighteous for God not to bless you and not to accept you. It's God keeping the threats that He had made as well as the promises. And again this morning, perhaps you are someone who has distorted God's word, has distorted the Bible that God has given us, and you focus exclusively on His promises. And there are certain promises which you cling to and you love, and you're relying upon those. And you're saying, well, it doesn't matter how I live, there's this promise I have. Therefore God will accept me. Therefore God will inevitably take me to heaven. God would be unrighteous. He would be unfaithful if He didn't, having made those promises. But Paul is reminding us that God has also issued threats. And for God to be righteous, He must keep to those just as much as to His promises. And so you can't rely on distorted promises, promises you've taken out of context. You can't rely upon those either. In verses 5 to 8, Paul deals with another little argument that the Jews might have raised in the light of what he said. If our unrighteousness brings out God's righteousness more clearly, what shall we say? That God is unjust in bringing His wrath on us. Or it's the same argument again in verse 7. If my falsehood enhances God's truthfulness and so increases His glory, why am I still condemned as a sinner? And so the Jews are saying that if then by us disobeying and being unrighteous, that magnifies God's righteousness in keeping His threats, then surely we're doing God a favor. And he's got no right to judge us when we are actually magnifying his righteousness. But Paul doesn't even really bother dismantling that argument. He just says it's ludicrous, basically. He says their condemnation is deserved. And so that's the third way, then, in which Paul is dismantling one of these things that the Jews were relying upon. They were relying upon distorted promises. And Paul says, you can't do that, because you've taken those promises out of context. And God has given threats as well, and he'll keep those. So, are you relying then this morning upon one of these things? Upon a privileged role that God has given you? Upon some right or external sign that God has put upon you? Or upon a distorted promise that you've taken from the Bible? Well, you can't. The fact is, Paul is saying, in God's assessment, you've broken his law. You're sinful. You have nothing you can rely upon. Well, are we going to end there and go home? Of course not. That isn't Paul's intention, is it? Simply to plunge us into despair. Paul's intention is always to keep bringing us back to what he's already said. The vital verse is in chapter 1, verse 17. We've looked at it in past weeks. Some of you might not have been here. In chapter 1, verse 17, this is the crucial verse you must keep remembering. In the gospel, a righteousness from God is revealed. A righteousness that is by faith from first to last. And you see, this is why Paul is so keen that we see we've got nothing to rely on in ourselves. It's so that we'll be driven to accept by faith this righteousness that God has provided. He wants us to see how bankrupt we are in and of ourselves. He wants us to see how impoverished we are in and of ourselves. We have nothing we can rely upon. But he says there is a righteousness. There is an approval from God, which we can have. Not through a role that we perform, or through a right we've had done to us, or through some promise that we've clung to in the Bible. There is an approval from God that we can enjoy by believing, by faith. Are you doing that this morning? Have you realized this morning that everything else is insubstantial for you to rely upon? Everything else will fail you. Everything else leaves you still in this negative assessment before a holy God, still him finding you inadequate and indefensible. All the things you might claim, all the things that you might bring to God will not alter or hide that fact for one moment. He finds you lacking and wanting in his sight. And so you have to come and believe. Because when you believe, when you exercise faith, there is an approval from God. There is a righteousness, a legal status, as we've put it before, of being in the right, which God will willingly confer upon you when you believe, when you place your faith in Jesus Christ. Please make sure you're doing that this morning. Please don't leave this building still relying upon unreliable things. Don't leave this building still thinking that there's something that'll get you through when God looks upon you, when God assesses your life. There's something that he'll find adequate, because there isn't. There's nothing. Nothing at all, whoever you are. You must come and by faith receive this righteousness from God. This righteousness that is despite your poverty and your bankruptcy. This righteousness that is despite you not having anything to rely upon. An approval from God. A state of being in the right with the awesome, omnipotent, holy God. Is that not wonderful? Is that not the greatest thing you could ever have? And it can be yours this morning if you believe, if you place your faith in God and in his Son, Jesus Christ. Amen.